Just so, Priestley's scientific pursuits were as likely to spring from writing as from, say, blowing bubbles. His friend Anna Barbeau described his laboratory as, quote, a strange mixed oleo of papers and books where a mass of heterogeneous matter, a chaos dark, nor land, nor water, new books like newborn infants stand, waiting the printer's clothing hand. Priestley's experiments on electricity began with his writing a distinct and methodical account of all that had been done by others. It was only from and through writing that he was led by degrees into a large field of original experiments. But writing wasn't just a vacuum safe from air. It was a factitious but analogous technology through which common air, itself a factitious composition after all, could be safely viewed and known in all its forms. Writing made air's parts at once apparent and visibly consistent with linguistic structure, with human grammars. From this perspective, written English looked especially good to Priestley because it showcased his native tongue's virtuous preference for transparent composition over enigmatic inflection, as in the future tense, which in English is usually conveyed through the use of auxiliaries like shall, will, or must, rather than through some mysterious mutation of the main verb. Here, as in his aerial philosophy, a compositional structure, though all too easily dismantled into small parts a tongue could trip over, was still preferable to a single elementary substance, indestructible and inalterable. For if it could just be made visible, composition also expressed relationships and showed where meaning comes from, how it can be arranged, that it can be arranged, that mediating forms inform and surround the very human tongue that presumes to bid them. So for Priestley, writing the air was a way of realizing it through an analogous, if factitious, form. Priestley's most famous and incendiary formulation, though remained the one we heard, winding to the end. The English hierarchy, if there be anything unsound in its constitution, has reason to tremble even at an air pump. In this formulation, as written, we can now see that the sublimity of technologies like the air pump, their ability to induce fear and trembling anyhow, lay in their capacity for showing from within it that knowledge consists of different kinds that can be dispersed in all directions. Writing, and especially writing in an English language whose elements were at once fixed and universal, whose grammar was a self-elucidating fiction, was for Priestley another such technology, and the prospect of dispersal that all such technologies held out was, at least to Priestley, a prospect truly sublime and glorious. Priestley's sublimely medium-centered science yielded a distinctive epistemological and ethical practice. Its premises were limitation, disappointment, even subjection to inherited flaws, to things we know aren't there, but can't say how or why we know it, to things we know must be there, but same problem, it's Gothic. Indeed, under the guise of expressing the different kinds of air, experiments and observations stages just this equivocal conception of knowledge. I was deceived at the beginning of the process, Priestley will say. New experiments unhinged whatever I had thought the best established. I could not immediately, upon seeing this phenomenon, form an idea of the nature of this air. I kept viewing this production of air with a considerable degree of surprise and anxious expectation. Such Gothic formulations of life in the lab look disingenuous to many historians of science. I agree that these are the airs of an ingenue. But precisely as such, they float a quiet hypothesis that simply to perceive that one might be inside a scheme is to experience, critically, a legitimate form of reality itself. From this point of view, it is only information, never knowledge, that we can us, and that, like common air, is always rearranging itself into new, yet uncannily familiar forms as different elements happen to enter and exit it for reasons known only to themselves. It is, after all, Priestley insists, only because he happened to live beside that brewery that he even noticed fixed air in the first place. Likewise, if I had not happened, for some other purpose, to have a lighted candle in front of me, I should probably have never made the trial that led him to the discovery of oxygen or vital air. Except that Priestley never quite made that discovery. First, an analogy. There is one scene in The Mysteries of Udolpho when Emily St. Aubert is trying to burn her father's letters without reading them. She's been instructed to do so by the dying scientist himself, and she's a good girl. She manages halfway. But she can't help reading a few words by accident as the flame is devouring the paper. The words tell her nothing. They do, however, give rise to dark moods and prompt her to see and feel things, including a ghost or two. As Terry Castle's shown, Radcliffe, like Emily herself, seems quick to dismiss the ghosts as mere specters of everyday melancholy, the vapors, I guess you'd say. I'd say they're just prototypes, or are they after images of the Gothic novel they're in? But media of knowledge? We aren't supposed to think so. Exactly similar, Priestley never knew or explicitly identified as oxygen what, after many guttering candle flames, he himself comes across in experiments and observations. The prestige of having given that kind of air its real name fell to a Frenchman, Antoine Lavoisier. Priestley, by contrast, retreated to a finally alchemical, indeed a historically Gothic, convention of naming and conceptualization. He preferred to tie this particular kind of air to phlogiston. He held that, for common air to support breath, that fiery element in alchemy, the mysterious fifth, and long imagined the secret of air's known combustibility, had to be extracted from it. This backward, evacuated, and frankly fantastic stance Priestley maintained to the bafflement and irritation of historian of sciences to this day, and to the mortification of the English pneumatic chemistry that he otherwise helped to transform and revitalize. Lavoisier's real discovery of the positive gas, oxygen, passed the torch to the French. We shouldn't see it that way. What Priestley had done, and was doing even here, was establish that the air we breathe and assume depends for its meaning on customary inherited form, on what is metaphorically in the air at the time. Like fiction, it tends to dissolve into the inherited linguistic conventions that we use to talk about it. We need it to. Priestley's aerial philosophy confronts this need and actively tests the limits of the symbolic habits that it sponsors. Ditto Radcliffe's aerial philosophy, and her experiments and observations are conducted in the same literary medium that Priestley's were. Where then, as Lawrence Stern would have said, lies the difference between them? I'm sure there are lots of places to look. As I said at the start, Priestley is out of print, but his formulations, like his fixed air, got loose from this medium. People think, even speak, through them and don't realize it. Science does, for example, try to know the atmosphere as a composition and by parsing its grammar, as Priestley did. It forgets, as he did not, that it and we are using metaphors and media to do it. What about Radcliffe? Here, you still can see the medium and its metaphors, but it is kind of all you do see. If you know her fiction, you know that the girls she writes about, like Emily St. Aubert, are more or less the first English majors. The Radcliffean heroine is never altogether certain of what it is she's seeing, though she knows how to talk about it and how to feel that it's about her. She inhales the smoke that rises from fragments of burnt letters and reads between lines carved on air-filled windowsills. Her long-lost lover returns, say from Paris, a city where, asserts the oh-so-English author, affectation so often distorts the air. The lover, that indistinguishable Valancourt, appears out of thin air while she's playing her lute and greets her with an equation, to wit, Emily, that air. When this happens, though, the deep twilight will not allow either the lover or us to distinguish the astonishment and doubting joy that fix her features. Having modeled the aerial suspension of disbelief that the modern knowledge of modern fictional worlds requires, the Radcliffean heroine disappears into thin air. She marries, as she does in the Italian, in an airy fairyland. Wished well, as is Emily St. Aubert by bookish servants who have read the fairy tales, she less exits the Gothic page and fades into it, leaving us unsure what to make of her. All of which is to say that, like Wright of Derby's bird, she and the different kinds of air that compose her and the things she knows about knowledge are finally fixed in fiction's fragile file. And that is where, for better or for worse, they have floated ever since.
Answer questions?
No.
Okay. Can you all keep on like that? Wait a minute, I see. So let's have a conversation for a few minutes. Anybody have any questions or observations?
Okay, I cheated and looked up in the OED to find out when gas came in as the alternative.
Yeah.
And apparently since 1790s it was already there from the Lafayette. And he doesn't choose it. He uses air instead of gas.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's there's anything to do with that. And I had a second question.
Yes.
That some of the self-conscious artificiality that comes in these air things in the Gothic remind me of descriptions of